Hi, I'm Peter Pack, and welcome to the Players Podcast. Our show is designed to provide another medium for learning and education for the soccer player. But on today's show, we're going to take a step back and we're going to examine an issue that's been running through our country this summer, and that's the issue of racial injustice and race relations. And so I want to thank in advance two players, Kai Kamara and Kellen Acosta, as well as a historian, Norton Herbst, who's joining us for this discussion. This is part one of a two-part series, and be sure to stay tuned to the end of this first show where we have one of America's foremost journalists to offer their thoughts on their personal experience of being a black man in America. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
The Players Podcast is dedicated to soccer players. Our goal is to provide discussion which stimulates the minds of players and serves as another opportunity to learn about the game and how to play the game. We'll explore a wide range of topics with some of the best coaches and most interesting people in soccer today, with the goal of helping players enjoy their journey in the game.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Kai, Kellen, Norton, thank you so much for your time. And why don't we just briefly introduce ourselves? And Kai, why don't you start?
Thank you, Peter. Hello, I am Kai Kamara, originally born in Sierra Leone, West Africa. But I had the opportunity to then move to America at the age of 16 to go to high school, basically. And over high school, two years in high school, 2 years in college, Cal State University, Dominguez Hills in California. And then jumped on, started playing professionally for Columbus Crew. And I've traveled, really, I'm a traveler. I started with Columbus and I was in San Jose, then Houston, then Kansas, lived another year and a half in England, playing over there and back in America. And I played in Canada, Vancouver for another season. And I'm here in Colorado. But, you know, a world traveler. I am also representing my national team of Sierra Leone. So traveling around Africa and different other countries, mostly. But soccer has really brought me around here, brought me around the world and showed me, you know, the opportunities that it is out there for people. And I'm really grateful for that. And also, yeah, it's made me be in rooms and I've met some really, really awesome folks along the way. So that's me. And I like soccer, but I love volleyball and I like to dance too. So
we'll save that for another show. Kellen.
Yes, so I am Kellen Acosta. I was born in Carrollton, Texas. It's a suburb of Dallas, Texas. I grew up most of my life in even a smaller suburb called Allen, Texas. Some might be familiar. We built a $90 million American football stadium with the same high school as Kyler Murray, quarterback of the Arizona Cardinals. So that's been most of my life in Dallas. I started playing professionally when I was 16, signed for the home team, played there for 8 seasons. And now I am currently a teammate of Kai Kamara's here in Denver for the Colorado Rapids. So, I haven't moved as much as he has, but I am also a world traveler. I've represented the U.S. at the senior level. I've been all around the world, met some cool people like Kai, and this game has blessed me to see different aspects of the world, and I'm definitely forever grateful for that. And hoping after COVID, I can see some more of the world. So that's a little bit about me as well.
Great, thanks. Norton.
Yeah, it's an honor to be part of this discussion because I am not a professional soccer player. I grew up in North Carolina and go Tar Heels. And I played a lot of soccer as a kid, like almost every American kid does at some point, and loved it. You know, I grew up in the world of college basketball and college football. So now I actually have two jobs. I'm a pastor at a church here in Denver, Colorado. And I also teach American history at both Denver Seminary, and I teach at the University of Denver. And my focus has been 20th century American history. So that's where my part comes in. I've been thinking and studying a lot as it comes to race relations and just the history of our country and where we are and how we got here.
Okay, and just bringing up the rear, myself, I'm Peter Pack. And like Norton, I grew up in the Southeast. I grew up in Georgia. My parents came from South Korea when I was about a year old. And so I spent my time growing up there. I went to school in Ohio, spent a good bit of time in New York, as well as some time in San Francisco, and now here in Denver for many years. And so let's dive into this. And as I thought about the way to provide some backdrop to the situation that we've been experiencing here this summer, there were two quotes that came to mind. The first is, "Daddy changed the world," and that's from Gigi Floyd, who is the daughter of George Floyd. And the second quote is, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war." And that comes from Abraham Lincoln, spoken to Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the book was written in 1852, and many view it as really the kind of the initial match that struck a fire in the heart of America and Americans everywhere that eventually led to the Civil War. And so when you think about that, that took about a decade from when that book was written until the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. And you fast forward to today and you hear Gigi Floyd's words, who honors her father with those words, and everyone sees what happens to George Floyd. And that took about 24 hours to result in just this, you know, very powerful movement that we've all seen here this summer. And so with that, let's start with the question of what it feels like to be a Black person in America. And just from my own perspective, you know, growing up as a person of color in the Deep South in the 1970s and 1980s, I have some views on the issue. But I think both myself and anyone else who is not Black can say honestly that we don't know. And so with that to start with, Kellen, why don't you offer us your thoughts on what it feels like to be a Black person in America today?
Yeah, it's definitely tough. Obviously, growing up, I didn't quite understand how life was. I was sheltered. I was privileged. I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood. So when people have made comments in the past saying why I play soccer, I should be playing basketball, should be running track, why I dress the way that I do, I should be wearing baggy clothes, I should be doing X, Y, and Z. And for me, I mean, it kind of didn't resonate till kind of all this happened, till it kind of really sparked an outrage in me that, I mean, a lot of that just wasn't right. And, I mean, what really stuck with me as a kid when someone told me I'm acting too white. And sometimes I just have to ponder that statement and wonder, what does that even mean? What do you mean I'm acting too white? Is that acting too white because I'm proper, that I'm educated? Is that trying to say that people that look like me can't be educated, or that people that are white are just superior? And yeah, I mean, I can go on and on about different situations I've kind of endured, but it's kind of just crazy that we live in this day and age where this is still an issue. I mean, I'm not as old as some of the guys here, but you just kind of see repeating patterns. And I think right now is a great opportunity for myself and for others to use our platforms to help promote change, because enough is enough. And the stereotypes that myself has gone through, my teammates, my peers, my brothers and sisters, is saddening. And it's always hard to play in a game called life when you're already down 1-0. And it's hard, and I feel like constantly I'm playing catch up, whether it's on the soccer field, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's to find a job, I just think it is not fair in that standpoint, and it's hard because I feel like anything that I have achieved in my career, I feel like I've had to work double because stuff just wasn't handed to me. It wasn't just I really had to work for it. And it's just something that is I feel like it hasn't been talked about enough. And I think that definitely needs to be expressed, and it needs to open up people's eyes. Because, like I said, change needs to happen, and people need to be more open-minded and stop being so sheltered and realize that myself as a Black man has endured so much, whether you like it or not, and it's kind of tough. I know it's a touchy subject about when people say Black Lives Matter, Black Lives are a Marxist group, but I mean it's more than just that. I just think, and people were saying All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, but for me, I'm just like, okay, you say Blue Lives Matter, which I agree with, for one, obviously. The policemen in our community are definitely essential, and without them, chaos would happen. But at the end of the day, being an officer is by choice, and being Black is not by choice. This is what I am. And I think people kind of fail to see that no matter what I do, like I'm an athlete, I'm a father, I'm a friend, but at the end of the day, I'm still Black, and people are always going to have certain remarks or certain views on me just because of my skin color. And I just think this world that we live in is just sad. And I'm hoping to inspire future generations that enough is enough, really. So, I mean, that's kind of just my general take on things. And I'm hoping that this discussion can enlighten those that are listening and help promote change.
No, that's great. And there's something you said in there about being too white. I want to come back to in 1 second. But Kai, switching to you, you know, as someone who comes from a different background, an international background, you know, your life experience, your journey is probably a little bit different than Kellen's, who grew up here in America. And so give us your experience and tell us what it's like from your perspective of being Black in America today.
Yeah, no, it's great to hear those things, Kel. And stop mentioning that you're a young guy in this group because you're not that young. Yeah, but it's great to just hear something, you know, from a young man like this, like Kellen, speaking about, you know, being Black in America. And I think one thing I can pick up from him is, you can be everything else, you know, this life matter, that life matter. But when it comes to it, it's some of them are profession. Why being Black is not a profession. It's just, you know, you, and that's it. That's how you were born. That's how you came into this earth. So yeah, I've been blessed really to be here in America and have the opportunities that we have. But right now being Black in America, to me, it's scary. You know, it's scary because you're always debating, you know, maybe it's, you know, about the police, or maybe it's not about the police. It's about, you know, other people that have different views of Black people, you know, but I'm looking at my rear view all the time, or I mean, in different areas. So we talk about what just happened just now with Jacob Blake. Like, that's scary. That is so scary that you see other things can happen. People get arrested. People get, you know, wrestle with, you know, police, you know, 2-3 police, they're paying you down, or, you know, taking it back to Amar, you know, Arbery, just going for a run, something I love doing. That's not just being an athlete, but just in general, I love running. And those things, when those things can scare you, then I can't just step out my house and feel like I'm comfortable because I'm wearing a hoodie, or I'm comfortable because this is the color shirt, or this is, you know, how I want to dress up today. I always have to think of to be very presentable for other people, because, hey, the area where you're going to, you know, if you dress like this, they're obviously going to put you in a category of, you know, bad people, because one, you're black, two, now you have to present yourself in the right way. So it's mostly I can say about being black in America today is it's scary. You know, I've been blessed to be here when I was 16, and I'm 36 now, and I'm a citizen of this country, and I proudly, you know, represent this country and be an ambassador of this country. But I'm getting text messages here and there from my, you know, family and friends across the world, and saying, man, your country is crazy. Like, are you guys okay? Are you guys okay? And hearing those things, I grew up from a civil war in Sierra Leone. Like, that's what I used to hear when I was there. You know, the families that we have in America calling us to check on us to see if we were okay. But then now it's the other way around again. So it's like the things have never gone away. And I have people over there calling here and checking on me. Are you okay? Are you okay? Because it's scary. We're seeing just another black man dead, another black man this, another black person this. So it's sad. It's sad right now in America.
Yeah. You know, Kai, you talk about just the thought of what to wear when you go somewhere. You know, it's not something that would pop up in my mind as the first thing, but it's obviously, you know, something that you're thinking on an everyday basis. What are some of the other, what I'll call nuances that you experience, and Kellen, you as well, that you experience every day, just these subtleties, these nuances that may be lost to others?
Yeah, I sorry, Kel, I'm gonna jump in front of you, but it's different, you know. It's like the things that a lot of people don't see, like you're saying yourself, being, you know, a colored person in America, you know, but you can't relate to being black. And it's basically like, if it's not what you're wearing, it's the places that you're going to, it's the eyes that comes back at you. Yes, yeah, so we don't try not to judge a book by its cover. You know, maybe somebody's admiring you when they're looking at you, but we know the difference of when someone is admiring you or when someone is judging you, or walking into a store and having, you know, security make sure they're not really following you from behind, but they're looking at every aisle. You will run by them a couple of times going through aisles, you know, so it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, similar to Kai, I mean, I've experienced stuff like that firsthand, where I'm going into a store and people are kind of just checking in on me a little bit too often after I said I'm fine a few times. And they're wondering what I'm doing, what am I looking at. Like, I don't know if they're thinking I'm going to steal it or something, which is, I mean, I don't think I've ever stolen anything in my life. But just stuff like that, or just little things of, like, from my frame, I mean, you shouldn't be scared of me. And I'm running or walking down the street, and I see people trying to hurry up and cross the street as I'm approaching them, you know, or I'm saying hello, or, and they give me weird looks. I don't know if it's people are just aren't friendly or what it is, but I feel like it's happened more oftentimes than not that I kind of take notice to it. And I mean, there's just so many little things that, I guess for me, just being privileged and where I've been, that it's kind of just gone over my head. And it's, yeah, just, I mean, it's just something that I've kind of just experienced and just got on with it, and I haven't really dwelled on it too much. And, you know, having an open discussion about it now, you kind of just peel back the layers and you kind of just think about all the little things that have happened in your life and that you didn't realize that just wasn't right, you know?
Yeah, and also, and to add to that, it's put me and me personally in a position where sometimes you're in a situation or in a place, maybe it's not what it looks like, but just because of the history of what you hear from a neighborhood, or you hear from a state, you know, from some parts or the things that you see from cops, that whenever, you know, somebody look at you that way, or somebody, you know, follows you that way, or somebody, you know, go across the street because you're walking on one side, even if maybe that's not what you're doing, but it just puts us into this uncomfortable position over and over and over, where like Kellen mentioned, he looks at his frame and looks at himself. He's not going to hurt anyone. He doesn't want to harm anyone. He just, you know, go about his own. But when you see some situations, if, you know, tonight I just felt like wearing a hoodie and go for a, you know, because it's chilly out, it's the fall and stuff like that. But then when I'm out, then I'm like, all right, you know what? I got to take my hoodie off because I feel like I'm making some people uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way just by how I dress. If I'm going for a run or going something late night, I feel like I need to wear something brighter so people don't feel more intimidated. Yes. If I'm wearing something darker, they're like, okay, he's up to no good. He might be, I mean, even when I go to the locker room, I'm wearing a hood because I know that's a safe zone. People, it's 100 degrees outside and I wear sweatshirts. Like, that's just who I am. But I just know when, you know, the sun starts going down, I'm like, okay, maybe the black hoodie, navy hoodie, maybe I need to stay away from it. Maybe I need to go for a brighter red or, you know, a yellow. But then now then you're stepping into a zone in certain areas that people are like, oh, you're in a red hoodie, then you must be a gang member. So it's like it's a fine line between a lot of different things. And I've heard different remarks and people saying certain things under their breaths or, you know, turning away, looking at me. I mean, it's there's no way to win. And it's definitely tough.
When I would add, as someone who's white, I didn't make that clear earlier, but I'm white. I've never thought about those things. Like, that just doesn't, like, that's never crossed my mind. I've never in my life had to have any level of heightened anxiety about what I'm going to wear or where I'm going to wear it or what time of day it is when I'm going to wear it or what streets I'm going to walk on and what way I'm going to walk down them or any of those things. And I think white people in America have to just start there and acknowledging there's a whole world of experiences that we've never experienced that black Americans have. And it's totally different. And that's a starting place for realizing the black experience in America is totally different than the white experience in America.
And I think the other thing that jumps out when you hear the remarks there is that it's on a daily basis. It's not just when, you know, something makes the news. This is every single day. Another thing I wanted to just throw out there to get everyone's perspective on, because I've lived in not every region of the country, but a lot of them. I've always wondered, do you think that the culture is different based on the region you live in? And Kyle, I'll start with you because you've played in, I don't know, I counted there, 6 or 7 different markets in the U.S. and Canada. But what thoughts do you have on that question of just the regional differences?
Yeah, I will keep repeating the word blessed. I'm blessed to have been so well traveled, you know, coming into this country and then being able to go and play in another country, whether it's Canada or the U.K., it's just been blessed. But yes, culture, I mean, that's something that we know everywhere, and not just America, but, you know, culture in Africa is different. The culture in my town of Kenema, where I was born, is different than the culture in Freetown, the capital city, you know, and coming here, playing in Columbus, the culture, and playing in Texas, where I play for Houston, the culture is completely different. You know, I played in Vancouver, where it's, I would say, dominant of Asians in Vancouver. So we felt like it was, I don't know, so chill, so relaxed, so everybody about their business and stuff like that. But, you know, being in other places, like, again, playing in Texas, where, you know, people love Texas. Texas people, you know, this guy, you know, Kellen Acosta would tell you that. We give him that in the locker room all the time. Texas is like its own country. You know, they represent it in a different way. Yeah, so, like, when I played there, you know, there's some of the people that I met, you know, and some of them was like, okay, I need to watch myself. I need to, you know, behave because they're not used to my kind here. And always I felt like, obviously, my safe zone is to always mention soccer. you know, when I start talking soccer and talking sports, and it's like, okay, you're okay now because I'm not talking anything else. So now people look at you and people, you know, maybe might treat you, I play for the Houston Dynamo. I play for, you know, the Colorado Rapids. And now people treat you a little bit, they're calm, at ease now because, you know, they didn't just see, you know, as a black guy, they're like, oh, you're an athlete. Oh, there you go. There you go. So those are the privileges also that we can say that other black people don't have that we have, me and Kellen can say, because I have that pass of saying I went to nightclubs where they're not trying to let me in because of what I'm wearing. And I dropped the card of saying, you know, hey, I'm a professional soccer player, you know, and then they're like, oh, okay. All right, come on in. And those kind of things. So the culture in different places, yes, I've experienced them and you see them, you know, and some places are actually what makes players. You can not be from Colorado at all, but you see some professional players that ends up staying in Colorado because the culture just fits kind of what they're looking for, you know, at the end of their careers.
Are there places?
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Kellen.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, just to reiterate what Kyle was saying, yeah, I live in the great country of Texas. Yeah, I mean, us Texans, we're very prideful. And I think from our standpoint, I think pride goes back and it's passed down from generation to generation. So it's basically systematic through family. So people's, you know, ideologies and philosophies on different things is passed down from generation to generation. And I think Texas, from what it's been, I mean, it's historically, it's pretty racist. I would have to add. I think it's like I said, just systematic. I mean, it's just generation to generation and people don't take interest into me, like Kyle was saying, unless I mentioned that I'm an athlete. But then it's one of those things that people are like, oh, I figured. I mean, I kind of get this whole viewpoint that I either should be, you know, dribbling a ball, passing a ball, being a rapper or an artist, and that's about it. And kind of to have only limited to those two things is frustrating for me because I feel like I offer more than just athletic abilities. But like Kai said, I mean, that's an avenue, that's a safe zone, and it allows people to kind of change their guard a little bit and to have that freedom and have that comfortable conversation. Because I feel like if I don't talk sports with someone, I feel like they feel like they can't relate to me at all. And so they don't want to have any type of communication. And kind of having that in Texas, I mean, I've kind of experienced that a lot in Texas. And sometimes, I mean, dropping the whole athlete card has kind of helped me. I don't want to say form relationships, but it's kind of helped me ease my way into a certain situation and have people be more welcoming than if I were just a normal person that didn't play a sport.
So success as an athlete has its privileges, but the flip side to that is that if you're not an athlete, you don't get those benefits that you might otherwise. And so there are really two ways of looking at that. But thanks for sharing that. Norton, as a historian, what's your take on the concept of, you know, regional differences related to this topic?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, historically speaking. I think personally for me, I grew up in the South, and my family was from the Deep South. And anyone who's lived in the South or spent time there or in Texas, I kind of separate those two, but Texas kind of has its own Southern type of roots, but knows that there is definitely a unique aspect of racism in the South, and particularly the Deep South. And yet I've also seen and noticed, we can sometimes tend to think that it only exists there, and everywhere else in the country, there's really not racism. It's just the Deep South, because that's where they still fly rebel flags and all those kinds of things. But I think we're also recognizing, with all the police brutality that's happening in places like Wisconsin and LA and all kinds of mostly urban areas outside of the South, that's a myth, and that there's significant racial injustice challenges all across the nation. They might have different flavors in different regions, but they're still there.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, I just got done reading a book entitled Everybody Lies. And it's somewhere between it's a book about big data, but it's somewhere between a kind of, an economic behavior book and a sociology book. But this is one of the first themes that it talks about. And it's basically asking the question of looking at prejudice and racism based on Google searches, and using that set of data, it basically says that we think of racism exists in certain pockets of the country more predominantly than others, but that's not what the data says. The data says that it's generally pretty universal, and so anyway, to echo that.
Okay. Yeah, there's a period in American history in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. It's called the Great Migration. And it's where things had gotten so difficult in the Deep South for Black Americans there that they just started leaving. They started migrating to Northern and Midwestern and Western cities. And this is when Black Americans flooded into places like Cleveland and Milwaukee and Chicago and all sorts of new booming cities, looking for a different way of life, looking to be accepted on different ways, thinking they were escaping how the bad racism in the South, and their experience when they got there was it was just as bad in all of these Midwestern and Northern cities in the country, and that things were no better there. So there's definitely some historical data points that really reflect that.
Oh, great. And that's a good little preview to kind of going back and looking at how we got here and just kind of a brief history of the Black American experience. But before we do that, just one last question before we move on.
Peter, before you do, sorry.
Yeah.
Before I lose the question in my mind, asking you and Norton, we talk about obviously how we grow up and how we feel in situations and being Black and all this. And I wanted to, then ask you too, growing up, it's the two parts to this question. Growing up, did your parents talk to you about, Black people?
So to answer your question, Kai, I grew up in North Carolina, and in the town and area where I grew up, there was a pretty large African-American population. So I was around a lot of other African-Americans, and my parents are actually from Mississippi and Georgia. So they grew up in the Deep South. In fact, my dad went to college in Mississippi, and he was in cities in Mississippi when Martin Luther King Jr. was coming through and marching for change during the civil rights era. So yeah, I heard about that. I heard stories about it. But again, my parents, as much as I respect them and love them, they were products of the Deep South. And so they had all kinds of assumptions about white people and Black people. A lot of subconscious or unconscious assumptions. And so I saw those, and in grandparents as well. I grew up with a lot of observations about life being white and Black. And some of that I've had to untangle over the last 20 or 30 years and figure out what's true and what's good and what was bad and what was not true and what was wrong and what was, what do I need to really think through?
Yeah, for me, Kai, growing up just in a first generation immigrant family, so we lived in an area that was it's a large public school area, but very high achieving, and so academics, athletics, as well as you know, what church you went to. I mean, you were expected to be a good person. And, you know, my first class of high school, meaning grade, it was the first grade that involved busing. And so, you know, busing from one neighborhood to another neighborhood. And so many of the guys that and people that I went to high school with were part of that first class of black kids in Atlanta who had a chance to go to a great public high school. And it's really, really incredible to see just, you know, the benefit of that, just on a personal level, but also just the experience that everyone had as a result of that. And, you know, went back to a reunion here recently, and just to see so many people that, you know, we all grew up together, and to see us now much older, it tells me that, and it shows me firsthand that type of experience in life is great for everyone, and that it impacted everyone in a very favorable way. But going back to your question of, you know, my parents, you know, my dad was a Methodist pastor, and he did a lot of work in the community, in a lot of immigrant communities. You know, that's almost like the town mayor, and so his phone rang a lot. But everything that, you know, we practiced in our home was very democratic, and it didn't matter, you know, what background you were of, what color your skin were. It was really kind of more of a look at your character. And that was the thing that, you know, my parents preached the most was, you know, your character is the most important thing, and never lose sight of that. So, thanks for the question. I think it's a good one.
Yeah.
And it's actually a great touching point for just this last point before we move on to some things that, you know, I think Norton wants to offer us. And it's basically the question is, as men with families, how are you talking to your families and to your children? And if you have boys, how are you talking to your boys about being black?
Yeah, well, I mean, my son is only 2 years old. He just turned two a couple weeks ago. So I really haven't thought about what I would say to him, but I'm honestly, and it's kind of sad for me to say this, but I'm honestly blessed that he doesn't have my pigmentation of skin. He's actually super light complexed with light eyes, so he almost looks like he's white. So I feel like he's not going to have to endure the same challenges that I've faced. And I'm hoping that what's going around in society now can spark change where when he's my age, he won't be going through the same situation. But I mean, from my standpoint, it's just about education. It's about just telling him the things that I've gone through, to be very careful of what you're wearing and how people perceive you. And like you mentioned before, it's you should judge people by their character, not on their presence or their pigmentation of their skin. And I'm hoping that he could learn. And I just want to reiterate. I mean, he basically looks light complexed, so I feel like he's not gonna have any troubles.
Yeah, that's you know, it's sad to hear that, you know, but it's true what you're saying, Kellen, because you know it's sad that a way of, you know, the color of our skin, you know, can get us out of some kind of trouble, which there it is now too at the same time, you know. But I grew up in Africa where also there, you know, there's the differences of, you know, one or two people or another tribe, say it's tribal one where this tribe is lighter than this tribe, you know, that did have the tribal wars, and it was easier for them to pick out who, you know, looked a certain ways and who looked the other way. So like, yeah, I have a son. I have, you know, my son Kendrick, 3 years old, and, you know, I have two girls. But to me, I hope the change does happen. You know, I don't want to have that conversation with them. I took them to the protest. You know, we went there because I want those things to be, I took my son, obviously Kendrick, and I want these things to be part of the history that, you know, the people that did march back in the days that, you know, there's photos of that, that people can say, yes, you know, we marched for freedom. We had freedom. Now we have the right to vote and all these things. And we can go into restaurants and all this. So people that was part of that, you know, people did make a lot of sacrifices and, you know, people lost lives. And, but for us, even for me to be an immigrant in this country, you know, a lot of people made sacrifices. I don't want to have to talk to my, you know, my kid, my son about, you know, how to take care of himself when he goes out to a certain place, or, you know, because that's how you get in trouble even more, you know. It's like playing soccer. Like, I get one yellow card. Now I'm really worried about, okay, I can't make a tackle anymore because it's going to happen. Then I take myself out of a lot of situations, and what happens, the coach just say, hey, let's take him out because he's not giving me 100, you know, percent. So that would be like that. If I start to tell my kid saying, hey, yeah, in that area, you can do this and this, you can do this. And, you know, it's great that you asked this because obviously that's what I was going to, and Peter, it's not my show, but I ask you questions too, but that's kind of the same thing I was, you know, I was thinking. I was like, do we have to talk to our kids about race, or do we just want to live, you know, in a diversity neighborhood and just let your kids be open to everything, so you don't really have to break it down to them saying, hey, you're black, be careful, you know, the white people are over there, the Asian people are over there, the Spanish people are over there, be careful what you're doing. Because obviously myself, when I moved to America, my mom, you know, was more over telling me about, you know, the neighborhood I grew up in LA, be careful, you know, there's gangs here, there's gangs there, but never really to say, okay, there's a Spanish gang here and there's a black gang here, so be careful which part of the street you walk on. So, you know, it's scary, and I hope that I don't have to talk to Kendrick or Karen or Kaylin about how they have to dress, how they have to look, you know, to go in a certain place, because they're too young, and hopefully change comes before then.
Great. Thank you. Okay, why don't we move on, and we'll move on by taking a step to go actually backward. And, you know, I think one of the most important things that's come out of this for, you know, certainly myself, but I think a lot of people as well, is a bit of an education. And while we've, you know, lived in this country our whole lives, there's still a lot that we can miss. And so I think that education process has been very helpful. And so Norton, if you don't mind, just through your eyes, just give us a weave of what the Black American experience has looked from a historical context.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I can't speak as a black person, so I should acknowledge that up front, but I can offer a few thoughts as a historian. And as you said, Peter, I think history is crucial. We just can't move forward at addressing racial injustice today until we understand the depth of the issues we've been facing and until we understand our history. So I just have a couple of thoughts I want to share. I mean, I could talk forever about this, but you guys would get really bored really quick. But I do want to share two thoughts and just maybe spur some discussion and see what you guys think about this. But two things that I think we need to revisit or come to terms with. And there are two myths that I think most Americans have had about race and our history. And the first myth is that African Americans gained their freedom after the Civil War, right? The common view, particularly of white Americans, but probably most Americans, is yes, slavery was really bad, and that's why we fought the Civil War to end slavery. And then when the South lost in 1865, slaves won their freedom, and they could begin to pursue all the opportunities that other Americans could. And that's just not true. On so many levels, that's not historically true. It's not true that most Northerners fought the Civil War to free slaves. Most Northerners fought the Civil War to stop the spread of slavery. It was spreading west into new states were coming to the Union. There were all kinds of debates about whether those states would be admitted as slave states or free states. So they fought the South to stop the spread of slavery. They fought the South to sort of stop the growing power that the South was accumulating. And then, of course, the main reason is they fought to keep the Union together. When the Southern states seceded, the Northern states, you know, led by Lincoln, said, you can't just leave the union. We're going to preserve the union. But it's important to understand all that because it really was only a very small group of abolitionists in the North who were actually fighting for the freedom of Black Americans. Most were not. And that's important because the Civil War ends, the North wins, right? And Black Americans are freed and slavery is abolished. Because Northerners had adopted that as a goal, and Lincoln, who didn't actually have that as a goal at the beginning of the war, only about halfway through the war did he actually adopt the position that we should outlaw slavery. It's important to acknowledge that because it means it really was never that important to them. Preserving the Union was the most important thing. Freeing slaves after the Civil War, kind of important, because it was the primary thing that had divided the North and the South. But giving equality to Black Americans, that was not important for Northern Americans during and after the Civil War. And that's why after the Civil War ends, the institution of slavery is done away with and Black Americans are no longer subject to it, but they're not given equal rights. They're not given equal opportunities. They're not treated equally suddenly anywhere in the country. And that's because most Northern white Americans deep down still held the same racial attitudes toward Black Americans that Southerners did. Most Northern Americans still saw African Americans as people of a different race who were probably not as smart, who are not as civilized, who are not as moral, who are not as peaceful, who, if left to their own ways, would be uncivilized and violent and all of these kind of things. And so the institution of slavery ended with the Civil War, but the racial hierarchy that existed in America was as strong as ever. And that's really important because it helps us remember or learn that the problem of race in America was never primarily about slavery. We tend to think it was about slavery and that was the main problem. And if you think that, then you think, well, once slavery ends in 1865, well, everything must have gotten better for Black Americans. But slavery was just a manifestation. It was a terrible manifestation, but it was a manifestation of racial hierarchy.
So I got a quick question for you. Obviously,
yeah.
And I'm new to America and I'm still learning the history of America, which I don't know much about.
Right.
And, you know, even blacks and stuff. So, because with all these, you know, police brutalities happening and all these things happening or people not getting arrested and stuff, then I hear something that went, oh, when they did declare, you know, all men are created equal, but Black people was not really part of that conversation. That is, you know, again, this is what I hear now or read. And, you know, again, can't believe everything that is out there. But they says, you know, through that saying all men are created equal, Black people were never all men at that time. So that's why when some of these things happen, some of the judgments of the police, the way it's going, or and people have not been persecuted for, you know, a lot of things that happen is because it's that violence of taking, you know, that violence that's been handled against Black people. We're still not considered equal to white people. Is that why? Is there something in there that did mention that?
Yeah. So that's that comes from the Founding Fathers documents. But you're right. It meant all white men are equal, and not even women, and just really men and all white men. Thomas Jefferson wrote that. And, in fact, in the same documents at the time in the Declaration of Independence and then later the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, they didn't even count African Americans or slaves as full humans because they had to count how many citizens were in each state so they could figure out how many representatives to have in Congress. And there was this huge debate because the South wanted to know, can we count all the slaves in the South as people? And at one level, they didn't want to count them as people, because if you count them as people, then you're acknowledging they're people, they're humans, and they have every right
that
everyone else has.
Is that the three-fifths compromise?
Yeah. So the compromise they came up with was the three-fifths compromise that said, every slave in the South will be counted as 3/5 of a person. But the point is kind of what you're getting at, is from the origins of our country, there was a racial hierarchy. Another way of putting it is a racial caste system, meaning whites are on top and they're seen as fully human, and black people, who at the time had been basically taken from Africa and put into the institution of slavery, were seen as not human. They were seen as people who were inherently violent or inherently not as intelligent or inherently not as civilized, and something that whites could continue to have control and power over. And again, slavery ends after the Civil War, but that doesn't mean the attitudes towards African Americans are changed in any sense or fashion. There's still a dominant attitude in America after the Civil War that, yeah, we're not going to enslave them anymore. That's kind of mean and that's wrong. And we've kind of come to the conclusion we shouldn't do that. But most white people still viewed themselves as superior to black people afterwards. And so because of that, you see from the 1870s all the way to the 1950s, there's all kinds of laws and policies and systems that maintain this racial hierarchy or maintain this deep inequity or inequality between whites and blacks. And many of us know these laws. Many of the laws came to be called Jim Crow laws. And Jim Crow laws meant black kids had to go to different schools than white kids. Black families had to go to different parks. They had to eat at different restaurants. They had to go to different restrooms. They had to use different water fountains. There were other policies that made it hard for African Americans to buy homes, to get promoted in their jobs, to own certain types of land, to live in certain neighborhoods, even to vote in elections, right? And that's where I want to lead into one more myth that we see. And the second great myth that I want to explore is that a lot of people think, well, then the civil rights movement comes along in the 1950s or 60s, and it addressed all of those inequities that still remained. And that's a huge myth. Now, the civil rights movement was amazing, and in many ways it did address some huge inequities in American society. So all those laws that were passed, you've seen the old pictures where someone who's black had a drink from a different water fountain. Those were mostly abolished, and the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964 that said there can be no segregation in public places. So you can no longer have a white-only park and a blacks-only park or restrooms or water fountains or anything like that. Education became desegregated. There was a Supreme Court decision passed, and that was huge. That meant you couldn't have black kids only going to these schools and white kids only going to these schools. They have to go to the same schools, and they have to have the same resources and be given the same opportunities. And in fact, in order to do that, gets to what Peter was saying. We're going to have to send some white kids to historically black schools and some black kids to historically white schools to start balancing things out. And that was huge. There was a Voting Rights Act passed that said black Americans could vote now easily. I mean, they could technically vote before, but there were states in the South particularly that had passed all these difficult laws that just made it really hard for black Americans to vote. And the Voting Rights Act did away with all of that. So the civil rights movement was awesome, and there's lots to celebrate there. But for any of us that have grown up or that grew up in the 1970s, or the 1980s, or the 1990s, what we now realize is that there are still so many aspects of American society where huge inequality exists, right? There's still that racial hierarchy where white have certain privileges and certain opportunities, and black Americans have certain barriers they have to overcome, kind of like you were talking about, Kellen. There's just these barriers, this extra work that they have to do to overcome that whites don't have. And you see all sorts of statistics, right? Black Americans are incarcerated at much higher levels than white Americans. Black Americans have much less wealth than white Americans. Black Americans have a much harder time getting leadership positions in business or in politics than white Americans. Black Americans don't go as far in educational opportunities. They have less opportunities when it comes to housing. In fact, when it comes to housing, where people live in a city, most American cities are still as segregated as they ever been, right? You kind of know what neighborhoods Latinos live in, what neighborhoods most Black Americans live in, what neighborhoods white Americans live in, right? And then police brutality is probably the biggest one. You know, as honest and as hardworking as most police officers are, there continue to be massive inequities in how white Americans and Black Americans are treated by law enforcement officials and by our judicial system. So I'll stop there by simply saying, if somebody thinks slavery was the biggest problem in America when it comes to race, and that was dealt with in 1865, and then any lingering issues were dealt with in 1965 by the Civil Rights Movement, then you'll continue to be blind to the ongoing experience of Black Americans today and how difficult it is. But if you can step back and look at our history and see that there has always been racial hierarchy, and there have always been policies that enforce that, like systems and laws and even unseen policies, then you can be honest in saying those still exist today. And so we need to ask tough questions about what are the policies or the laws or the unseen systems that are still maintaining those social inequities today.
It's so important, and it's such a great point, Norton, that the historical journey and the historical context has to be one, put into place, but also that we just have to be honest with ourselves, because that really is the first place where change can happen, is that honesty and that reflection, and just having an authentic heart as you look at this. And so thank you for sharing that. So that concludes part one of our series, Race and the Soccer Player. Join us for part two, where we actually dive onto the field and discuss some of the experiences that players have had involving racism, both on and off the field, as well as offering some thoughts about how we move forward. As we conclude this first show, we want to leave you with some thoughts and reflection from Bryant Gumbel, one of the most successful journalists who's covered sports, among a wide variety of other topics, for a long, long time. And so, with special appreciation and gratitude to HBO and Warner Media for allowing us to share this, here's Bryant Gumbel.
Finally tonight, as we close out this Real Sports edition devoted in great part to racial injustice, a few personal words seem fitting about what some friends and I often refer to as the black tax. It's not an IRS thing. It's the added burden that comes with being black in America, and it's routinely paid, no matter how much education you have, how much money you make, or how much success you've earned. The black tax is about more than just the added stares, whispers, and suspicions when you're out and about. It's about the many instances of disrespect and incivility your color seems to engender, and being expected to somehow always restrain yourself lest you not be what white Americans are never asked to be, a credit to your race. It's about living a life that included your father having to leave home to earn his law degree, even though he was an honor student and a decorated war veteran. It's about your son getting arrested for doing nothing more than walking while black. And it's about having to be more concerned than your white friends and associates for the safety of your grandkids. It's about the day-in and day-out fatigue of trying to explain the obvious to the clueless. It's about being asked to overlook blue failings and white failings so they can be conveniently viewed as black issues. It's about being asked by so many what they should do or say about race when the easy answer lies in the privacy of each person's heart. It's the black tax. It's paid daily by me and every person of color in this country, and frankly, it is exhausting. I've been paying the black tax in America for almost 72 years now, long enough that I shouldn't have to ask others to simply accept one very basic reality, that our black lives matter. Thank you for being with us. Stay safe. Good night.